Before getting started into the topics that were covered today, I thought it would be good to provide a brief overview about what we have covered today in the morning in the third lecture of this course. So in the last lecture, we have seen the architecture of a feed-forward neural network, which is one specific architecture in the deep learning community. And we have also seen the application of feed-forward neural networks in the context of supervised learning. And we have seen why it's better than, for instance, logistic regression, since we've seen that logistic regression is a linear model and feed-forward neural networks could be seen as non-linear models. We have seen also that feed-forward neural networks have parameters that can be categorized into classes. So we have weights. So those are the parameters that are multiplied with the values of each neurons and biases. Those are the parameters that shift the values that we get when we multiply with the weights parameters. We have also seen examples of different activation functions. So the ones I have presented in the lecture were the common uses, were actually the common functions that are used in the machine learning community. But this doesn't forbid that the fact that you could use your own customized nonlinear activation function. And it's also something that's it's a topic of ongoing research. And you might find papers where they define some new activation functions. So that's one comment if you're curious to learn more about that. I also briefly commented about the fact that feed-forward neural networks can, in principle, theoretically approximate any given function that you have to arbitrary accuracy. We have seen also a caveat that this means that you might need to consider like an arbitrarily large number of hidden neurons in your hidden layer. So there's a caveat here that it doesn't mean that any architecture will approximate any function. You might need to make it very large so that you can make this work. And you can see how this will work in practice, hopefully in the tutorial next week. So you'll see how the different hyperparameters, such as the depth of the neural network, the width of the neural network, how the size of the neurons would affect your accuracy. So this is something you'll have more experiment. It will be experimented with in the next tutorial next week. Another thing we've seen briefly at the end of the lecture today was the different cost functions that we could choose in order to train these weights and biases. So these cost functions are a way to quantify the error we're making on the true labels. And we've seen, in particular, the mean squared error, or MSE, and also the cross entropy. So those are common choices of cost functions that you will also have a chance to experiment with in the next tutorial as well. Okay, so all of these things are actually implemented in PyTorch, so you'll have like it'll be much easier for you to play with these tools without having to play this from the ground up. Okay. Now, in this lecture, I'm going to continue the discussion on how we will train feed-forward neural networks. So now, beyond cost functions, I'm going to explain how we're going to optimize these weights and biases. And so this will motivate one famous algorithm. It's called backpropagation that will enable us to train the weights and the biases that we have in the feed-forward neural network architecture. And then I'm going to talk about overfitting. And I'm going to comment about it in the next lecture. So I'm just going to present to you like a small examples of what is overfitting and why it's something that we need to think about when training these architectures. Okay. So the first thing I want to start with is about how we're going to train the weights and the biases. So if you remember in the previous lectures last week, we have seen one learning algorithm called gradient descent, which consists of, we've seen this in the context of logistic regression when we wanted to minimize the mean squared error. So the mean squared error is an example of a cost function that we can define. So what we can do is do a gradient descent with respect to the weights and the biases in such a way that we minimize this cost function. And we do this for all the weights and biases in each layer. Okay, so remember we have different layers, and we want to do this for each weights and vices in each layer. And our goal at the end is to have these weights and vices, like these weights and vices, satisfy the following equations. So we want the derivative with respect to the weights to be zero, and also the partial derivatives with respect to the biases to be zero, in such a way that we know that we are at the minimum, or either a local minimum or a global minimum. Okay. So if we want to do this exactly without using gradient descent, then what we might need to do is to solve these equations exactly, similarly to what we have done, for instance, in linear regression. But one caveat here is that if you see, for instance, the architecture of feedforward neural networks, we can define arbitrarily large number of neurons in each layer. We can also define a large number of layers, a very deep layer. So this means that the number of parameters can actually be very much, much larger than the dimensionality of each data point. So in linear regression, if you remember, the number of parameters was exactly equal to dx. But for feedforward neural networks, that's no longer the case. This number of parameters can be either smaller. I presume, like if you, for instance, use the same weights for like the same, like for the same parameter, for this all the, so you could, the comment I want to highlight here is that you could, this could be either smaller or larger, but typically in real-world applications, the number of parameters is actually much larger compared to the dimensionality of each data point. So the long story short is that it would become much, much difficult to solve these equations analytically for in real-world applications, for in order to get the weights, weight matrix, and also the set of biases. Okay. So this will motivate the use of gradient descent as a learning algorithm for finding an approximation of the optimal weights and the optimal biases. So generically, we can beyond like having only weights and biases, we can think about any parameterized model that have a certain set of parameters p, p1, p2, until p capital N, where a capital N is the total number of parameters. What we ideally want is to have these parameters satisfy this equation for all k between 1 and n. In capital N. So as I've mentioned here, that's difficult to do because if we have N that's very large. So instead, what we can do is do gradient descent in order to find like an approximation of these equations so that we can go to the minimum as much as we can. So if we're given some cost function that has a landscape that looks like the following. So let's imagine that we have a landscape like this. And assuming that we're somewhere over here, if you recall, the idea of gradient descent is to do the updates the opposite direction of the gradient so that we go down. So if we do these steps many times, then we eventually will land over the global minimum in that case. But that's not necessarily the case because we might initialize our parameters in such a way that we are somewhere here. So in that case, if we do gradient descent, then we might land over a local minimum. Okay, so the message here is that gradient descent will allow you to find a local minimum, not necessarily a global minimum. Okay, so to remind you of the gradient descent update that we do. So what we do is we take each parameter k and we update it with a new parameter pk minus the gradient with respect to pk weighted with some parameter eta, which is called the learning rates, if you remember from the last week. Okay, so this learning rate is also another hyperparameter in addition, for instance, to the number of layers and the width of each layer. So this is like another thing that you will have to tune if you want to optimize your architecture. And as I've mentioned here, this gradient descent algorithm might provide us with a local minimum instead of the global minimum. So that's why there is a lot of research going on in this field, so that we can develop better variants of gradient descent that would allow us to like circumvent local minima. And this is what I'm going to talk about right now. So one variant of gradient descent is the so-called stochastic gradient descent. So there is stochastic. Can you see from here or no? Is it visible for you? Okay. It's also called SGD. And I'm also wanna, in the same time, also wanna talk about a similar variant called mini batch gradient descent. I believe this one, I didn't find an acronym for that one, so I'm going to leave it like that. So to motivate like this stochastic gradient descent, so I'm going to define the cost function as the following. So if you remember, like from the last lecture this morning, we had the cost function was a kind of an average over all data points in the data set of some smaller cost function that quantifies the error that we're making on each individual data point. So C could be either a mean squared error on each individual data point, or it could be the cross entropy. So this is a kind of a way to generically write the cost function. And the idea is that we approximate the cost function, which is in principle a sum over all possible data points that we have in the world. But what we do is we only take a small subset by taking only a data set that we have available in a real world application. So here, what we do is we sum over all the data points that we have in our data set, but instead what we can do is take our whole data set and which will be made of each individual data point. So let's imagine that we have M. So M would be the size of the data set. So in that case, like we're by feeding all these data points to the, for instance, the feedforward neural network, we'll be able to estimate this cost function as it is right now. But one way of like doing gradient descent is by only picking one data point at a time and computing the gradients with respect to each individual cost function, small c. So one idea is to do gradient descent with respect to the individual data points. So we go from I goes from 1 to m, okay? So instead of doing the gradients with respect to the whole data's average cost function, we do it on each small individual cost, okay? And you might guess that this would help with the the local minima, because as you see here, like this cost function is defined for one data set, so it's something that's like a static landscape. But if you do this for different cost functions, for these small cost functions, each time you update, you'll see a different landscape. Okay, so you'll have, each time you do the update, the gradient optimizer will see a different landscape, and you'll have a different set of local minima. So stochastically, you hope that you'll not be stuck in the local. Of course, this doesn't happen in practice. You'll still be stuck in local minima, but at least you'll land in a better local minima that's lower than the one that you expect. Okay. So that's one advantage of this approach. One downside of this approach is that you might get a very noisy updates of optimization of your parameters. That's because this average kind of smooths out the landscape and it becomes less noisy. So this motivates the use of this mini batch gradient descent. Where what we can do is shuffle all the parameters, all the data points, and then we can take a batch, divide the data set into chunks, where each chunk we can call a batch B that has size cardinal of B. Okay, and we can define the cost function. Now, C that's defined on the batch is the average over all the data points in each batch, or in each mini batch. So in that case, we're taking the best of two worlds. We're taking the best of this because the averaging will smooth out the cost function. And we also take the best of this approach in such a way that the landscape will change from one gradient step to the other. Okay. So this is the rationale behind this approach. So in particular, you can see that SGD boils down to having a batch size 1. And for mini batch, you'll have a choice between a batch size that will go from 2 until the size of the whole data set. Okay. Of course, this has to be a multiple of the data set, okay, in order for this to work. Okay. Are there any questions so far? Yeah.
So in the stochastic gradient descent,
yeah,
each step, which x do we choose? Do we go in order? Or?
Yeah. So xi correspond to all data points in the data sets.
Yeah, but.
So we can go in ideally we go in random order. So that we don't this random order introduces another kind of noise in the landscape optimization. So it's always good to optimize the parameters in different orders of that data set. This is also a common practice in machine learning applications, and it's also good to do that for mini batch. So each time you choose a partition of this data set, it's always good to shuffle the data set so that you get a different landscape each time you optimize. Okay. So this is all heuristic and it's based on intuition. But there are also other theoretical work in the literature of machine learning showing that this is a very good idea. And in practice, the size of the batch, one number that you could choose is at the order of hundreds. If you have a very large data set of 10,000 or a million, it's a good idea to choose B, not too small and also not too big. So you'll see this in one tutorial by the end, in 2 weeks from now, that we'll use convolutional neural networks. And you'll have the opportunity to play with this parameter. So this is just one recipe for choosing this parameter, but you'll see the effect of this number later on in the tutorial. Okay. So before moving on to the other gradient descent optimizer, I wanted to share, to show you the intuition behind mini batch gradient descents and stochastic gradient descents on the TensorFlow playground. Yeah, but yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
So when you update your parameters for each of the xi's,
yeah,
data points. So what's the final parameters that you use? Is it like the average of all the updates?
Yeah, so what we do is actually you do a for loop over all these updates. So at the end, like, you get like a sum of all, like this parameter minus the sum of all the gradients from that comes from all the other contributions.
Well,
you see the idea?
Sum over I? Or?
Yeah, it will be a sum over I of all these gradients times the learning rate. Yeah, that's a great point. But of course, So maybe I should like say more about this. Like what we do is, we do like a for loop over also over k, the number of parameters. So it's a two for loop. So you can see that can be much slower compared to doing an average over the whole data set.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I think you can now see the screen. So what I wanted to highlight here is first the fact that there is a hyperparameter in TensorFlow playground that you can also play with later on if you want. So the batch size one means that we do stochastic gradient descent where we only show one example at a time. Okay. So if we do this and we optimize this feedforward neural network, you see that it's very unstable. You see, like, it's not good, like, which is expected because we don't do the average in here. And if we increase the size of the batch now, let's say we choose 15 and we do the optimization, you see that we get something that's smoother. Okay, so it's always good to choose the batch size that's bit more, like much larger than one. So in real world applications, you'll see that if you choose at the order of like 100 or it doesn't have to be exactly 100, but it's just a recipe that you can start with in your when you explore this hyperparameter. Okay, so this is quickly what I wanted to show you here. Now I'm gonna go back to the blackboard to talk about another gradient descent algorithm called momentum gradient descent.
Mohammed?
Yeah.
Can you explain why B is 1 in gradient stochastic gradient descent?
Yeah, so if B is 1, this means that this cost function CB is like, it will be just
one term,
which is exactly what we do here. If we have a mini batch, then that will be an average over these individual cost functions. And we will do gradient descent on this cost function. CB.
So what is stochastic about it?
Yeah, so it's stochastic in the sense that, so let's say at, like for the first example, like let's say for x1, then the cost function might look something like that. So that's cx1 with respect to some parameter pk. But for the second example, like for the second data point, then the cost function could look completely different. So we could still, like if the global minimum is somewhere over here, we could still have some global minimum here, but a different structure somewhere else. So updating these, like updating the parameters with respect to CX1 and CX2 will allow you to like overcome, for instance, circumvent. So for instance, if there's no local minimum here, updating on this cost function would allow us to circumvent this local minimum that's over here. But if you only have only one static cost function, for instance here, and if you're stuck here, then you don't have another way to get out.
So stochastic means I randomly choose xi, right?
So yeah, like the stochasticity comes from the fact that you'll have different landscapes and like you choose like x randomly from the data. So you choose a random order.
Well, only one.
So yeah, only one, and then you actually choose a different order for going through your whole data set. So you start from, let's say, data point number 100, and then you go to data point number 1, and then to 2, and so on and so forth. Okay, does that make sense?
That makes sense, yes.
Okay, cool.
Hi, Mohamed. May I ask about how do we determine that the size of the batch is about the order of 100?
No, that's like just a like a recipe for, it's not like something theoretical.
So is it that theoretically speaking that the larger the batch size, the faster that we can learn the weight?
Not quite. Like the larger the batch size, the faster your gradient, you'll go through your whole data set because you'll have less chunks in your data set and you'll have to compute gradients less often. So you'll do gradient descent much faster, but this doesn't guarantee that you'll land over a better minimum. In stochastic gradient, like stochastic gradient or mini batch gradient descent, if you choose B smaller, then you'll do more updates, and this might help you to find like a better minimum. But the downside is that you'll have noise when you're optimized, and you'll also have more time to do the updates. Okay, does that help?
Yeah.
Okay. So now, yeah.
So in general, stochastic gradient descent is unstable, right? So in practice, it's always better to use mini-batch in practical applications.
Oh, so your question is whether this is better than mini-batch?
The opposite. In practice, it's always better to use mini-batch because...
In practice, it's always to use the best of stochastic gradient descent and plain gradient descent. So this is kind of like a solution in the middle. So you're kind of benefiting of the both worlds. So in practice, people use that for training their neural networks. Does that help? Okay.
So when we do these methods or in practice, are the gradients computed numerically? Because analytically, it's a...
Yeah, so... Like there is like a technique in this field called automatic differentiation. Or also ADA, like, so that's like a technique that allows you to compute gradients numerically and also exactly without using finite differences. So if you have like an expression like f of x equal to x squared, then automatic differentiation algorithm will allow you to compute the first derivative and also other derivatives exactly without having to use finite differences. So everything is taken care of in terms of computing gradients when you use PyTorch, for instance, so you don't have to worry about computing gradients. You will just provide the cost function and the package will do everything on your behalf, okay? Any other questions? Okay, so if not, then we'll move on to momentum-based gradient descent optimizers. So now we're gonna add momentum to the game. So this is already something that we know in classical physics that notion of velocity and momentum. It seems that it's something that's very helpful here because you can think of your parameter as some sort of particle that moves in a potential, and it's always good to add some sort of velocity. So if it has some velocity over here, that very large velocity, then it can help to escape the local minima. So it seems that it's something that's physically inspired, so where physics can actually help to develop better gradient descent optimizers. So the idea is to define some velocity v that's initialized initially to zero, or to some value initially, and then we update it at each step to the following. So we do so the parameter here beta is called the momentum decay. And the idea is that each time we update the velocity, we add like a portion of the gradients plus the previous contribution, the previous velocity that we have. So beta is something that's between 1 and 0. Okay? So the idea here is that we want to keep a memory of the previous gradients. So one good way of seeing this is like the gradients is some sort of acceleration. So if you have an acceleration, that would help you to get more velocity. So that if you have, for instance, the opposite velocity at some point, you'll still keep moving in the other direction until the velocity turns to the other direction. So this is like intuitively what would happen. Yeah, go ahead.
The derivative goes to zero when you're at a local minimum, but we know for some of these cost functions they have a global minimum at zero. Why would you not use the cost function itself as that metric for deciding how much acceleration you needed? So when you were far from zero, you would move fast, but when you were close to zero, you would move more slowly.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah, if we only use the cost function over there, it will be as if like consider the parameters as positions and the derivative of the cost function as the velocity. So if like for instance if at the minimum the derivative is zero, the velocity will be exactly zero. So you'll be stuck in that local minimum. You'll not be moving. Whereas like here, if we do this, we're considering the derivative as the acceleration. So if the acceleration is zero, you'll still have some memory of given in the velocity that would allow us to move even if we achieved a local minimum.
It just seems strange to predicate the algorithm on the derivative rather than the cost function itself if the cost function goes to zero.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So if the cost function, like if we are using the mean squared error, what you said is right. We could use the magnitude of the cost function, but if we use like cross entropy, that might not.
Right.
Yeah, it's like the minimum is not zero. Yeah, that's a good point. Or let me think about it again. Yeah, but I guess generically the minimum of the cost function is not always zero. It can be like some constants. Yeah.
But it's convenient if it is, because then you know what the global minimum is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But but it's always like, it's not always good to find, like it's not always possible to find a global minimum in real world applications. Like typically what we end up with is like local minimum that allow us to get a good prediction of our labels. Yeah. So this is why this recipe like doesn't assume that we know the minimum of the global function. Yeah, that's a great point. Okay, so now going back here, we have a momentum decay hyperparameter that's tuned. So I'm gonna show you in a quick in a second how this does on a real world application. But yeah, go ahead if you have a question.
Quick question. So if the meaning of the beta is acceleration, then why not the sign is a minor sign?
Sorry, which
acceleration should be the minus partial after minus of the gradient.
Oh, you mean here minus?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So this like I forgot to mention another step, which is the step where we do the updates of the parameters. So when we do the updates, we actually do the updates with using the velocities. So eta now is the learning rate.
Nice.
So this is where we see there is a minus sign, and that will give us a minus sign here. So this means that this is in accordance with the gradient descent algorithm principle. Okay. You can see here that if beta is zero, This means that we will not have in like each time we do like a step, the velocity will be just the gradient. So it's same as a stochastic gradient descent. Oh, sorry, same as a gradient descent algorithm we've seen before. And so that's why it's always good to choose beta larger than beta, and also not equal to one. Because if its beta is equal to one, then you will not get any information from the gradients. So one recipe is to choose like beta 0.9, 0.8. So I'm going to show you in a second how this would look like in a demo. But before doing so, I wanted to give you an intuition about why momentum is better than plane gradient descent, in addition to this physical intuition that this is an acceleration and this is some sort of a velocity. So beyond this intuition, like you could also think of the cost function landscape. If we have a contour plot like this, so for instance, if we're somewhere here, then this is like a larger values of the cost function. If we're here, this means that we're at the minimum. So this is one way of representing that cost function. And if we are somewhere here, and if we start with gradient descent, then we might do some sort of oscillations to get to the minimum. So if we start like somewhere over here, that could be possible. So whenever we have oscillations, this means that you have slow learning. But with momentum, since we have this velocity, this will not happen because each, like the velocity will be going this way. So the updates will be something like this. So we will learn the minimum much faster compared to the gradient descent with no momentum. And this is with momentum. So this is one intuition. So before going to the demo, I also wanted to highlight that there are also other advanced gradient descent optimizers called that are based on the idea of adaptive learning rates. As you might guess here, the learning rate that we choose could be something that changes as we optimize. So ideally, we want to have a large learning rate in the beginning to make larger steps and smaller learning rates as we're getting closer to the minimum. So it's always good to think about adaptive learning rate schemes. So there are algorithms that do that. So there is, for instance, you might hear like something like RMS prop. And algorithms like ADAM. And so I'm just giving you the acronyms here. I'm not going to explain because they're a bit technical. They would require another lecture or so to explain them. So I just wanted to highlight that those gradient descent algorithms exist. And you can find them on PyTorch. So for instance, and if you go to torch.optimization, in PyTorch, you'll find all the built-in gradient descent optimizers, and you'll have a chance to discover them in the tutorial next Tuesday. Yeah, go ahead.
Is there a reason why we're not using conjugate gradients?
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, so I believe like conjugate gradient is something that's easier to implement when you remember, like in the numerical net methods course, we have done this for solving the linear equation AX equal to B. And this was possible, I presume, because we have a linear system. I guess here, it's challenging because we don't have that anymore. And I also believe it's challenging because we could have a lot of parameters. So we typically could have many, many parameters that would make conjugate gradient challenging to do here. So this is like what I can think of off the top of my mind, but yeah, I could check again and confirm that. But Hope that answers your question. So I also wanted to highlight that there are also other algorithms based not only on the first derivative of the cost function, but also on the second derivative. And the second derivative is very important because it tells information about the curvature. So there are also other algorithms based on the second derivative and called the second order optimization techniques. But those are mostly like more expensive optimizers that are used in only some fine-tuned applications. Okay, so now it's a good time to go to the demo to give you an intuition about for the different optimizers that you can choose. You can see this. So as you can see, so that's like a software that allows to visualize how different gradient descent algorithms perform. So we have simple gradient descent, we have gradient descent with momentum. So we have this decay rate, which is this momentum decay parameter. We have ADA grad, RMM's prop, Adam, I would say Adam like is one of the most successful optimizers. So this is like one of the best optimizers out there in the literature. So I would recommend you to choose it, like if your gradient descent is not working. And let's see why that's the case here. So let's imagine that we're putting all the optimizers over here, we're initializing over here. You see that momentum is the fastest to go to the minimum. That's because of this idea of velocity, like each time the acceleration is increasing the velocity more and more until you find the minimum. Okay, so this is where a case where momentum is better than gradient descent. We'll see why Adam is better in another case, which is the case of local minimum. So let's imagine that we have a local minimum in that case. So if we initialize somewhere over here, momentum will get stuck in that local minimum, in addition to gradient descent. But Adam, with an additional adaptive learning rate mechanism, allows to find that global minimum in this experiment. So this is like an example for where you can improve over momentum-based optimizers. Another example of a surface that you could have is the following, a saddle point. So again, here you see Adam managed to find the minimum much faster than the other optimizers. So if you're interested, I would recommend that you experiment with all these optimizers using this software called gradient descent visualization. Okay, so this is what I wanted to show you right now for the demo. Now going back to the Blackboard, I wanted to talk a bit about backpropagation. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So I wanted to see if increasing the velocity would make the out of the...
Yeah, let's do that. Yeah, maybe it will be. Yeah, but if you want, I can show you at the end. But the idea is that if you increase the parameter beta, then you expect the velocity to increase.
Yeah.
And if your beta is very small, then you see the velocity is like very is you see that the behavior will get closer to the gradient descent. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
Can you give us some intuition as to what Adam is doing exactly? Like it had some parameters, and we saw, for example, that it's stuck between the two minima, and then it kind of decided to go to the.
Yeah. That's a great question. I should highlight that Adam is not like an algorithm that would find you the best global, like the minimum necessarily. It's a good optimizer for circumventing local minima. So it's a good optimizers, but it doesn't always guarantee to get that global minimum. So this is one caveat I want to highlight. I think the reason why Adam is better is because of this additional adaptive learning rate scheme, which it's very challenging to explain that in few words, but I guess that's like the additional ingredient that's baked into that optimizer that makes it better. If you're interested, you can search on this paper that presents Adam that would provide with more detail. And if you want, I could also explain it separately later on.
Thank you.
That's a great question. Let me now talk about gradient descent. About backpropagation in feed-forward neural networks. So we have seen that gradient descent over there requires the knowledge of the gradients, in particular, the gradients of the with respect to the weights, and also with respect to the biases. And now the question is how we can calculate these exactly and efficiently using some suitable algorithm. And it turns out that backpropagation is a way to compute these gradients. And if we look back again at the expression of the architecture of feedforward neural networks, so we have the output layer and the hidden layers and also the input layer. So it looks like that it's more straightforward to compute the gradients with respect to the last layer, because this is because we know that the cost function will x will be some sort of difference between the outputs of the neural network and the labels. So it's a good idea to start from the gradients with respect to the parameters in this layer and the output layer, and then to go back layer by layer. And this is what motivates the idea of backpropagation. We do some sort of chain rule so that we can propagate the gradients from this layer to the previous layer, and then again a chain rule to go from that layer to that layer, and so forth, and so on and so forth. Okay, so this is the intuition here. Now, in terms of the math, what we can do is define, again, the cost function as the average over all data points, and then instead of computing the gradients with respect to the average, we can start from each individual cost on each individual data point. And once we have the gradient with respect to small c, then by doing the average, we can get the whole gradients. Okay, so let's do that for one training sample x. So to do that, we're going to use the convention that we used before in the lecture this morning, where we have AJL is the value of the jth neuron in the Lth layer. And we have a nonlinear activation function applied on some combination of different neurons in the previous layer. We're going to call this ZJL, where ZJL is what you have seen in the previous lecture as the sum over all the values in the previous layer of the previous neurons. I should use a different index here. I should use I, where I goes from 1 to the number of neurons in the previous layer, which is NL minus 1. And I should, again, multiply with a weight matrix and with add the bias. And so that's the expression that we have seen in the previous lecture. I just defined this variable C. That's all I've done. And now we're going to define this variable delta JL, where it's defined as the derivative with respect to small c. So I'm going to drop x. C would be exactly this small c over here. Okay, so let me do this, or maybe not. Let me do just the small c, okay, for clarity. So we're going to take the derivative of small c with respect to that variable z, okay? So now if we want to if we like want to take the gradient with respect to the small c, you see that c, small c is a function of the outputs of the last layer, okay, in addition to the labels which are implicit in this dependence. But the labels are not trainable, so we can drop them here. So what we can see is that if we consider that that parameter delta JL for the last layer, which is capital L over here, so that will be the derivative with respect to z j capital L. And we can actually, since we have a dependence of small c on AL, then we can actually do a chain rule. So we can first take a derivative with respect to A, and then multiply that with the derivative of A with respect to z, okay? So that will give us derivative of small c with respect to A, j, L, times derivative with respect to A, j, L, with respect to z, j, L. Okay, so now the reason why we can do this is because if you see here, z and A are directly related by this nonlinear activation function, j, L. So this is why we can do this chain rule. Okay, you have any questions about this? Yeah?
Shouldn't it be AIL, AIL? Because I think there's supposed to be some double node.
So over here, I?
Yes, aren't we summing over them? Because you are taking...
Oh, yeah. So I'm not using this equation yet. I'm only using that one. So this L can go from 0 to L. And we're using this equation for L, small l equals to capital L. So I'm only taking advantage of this one. Of course, like when we will have, like when we'll backpropagate the gradients to the previous layers, we will need to make use of these equations. So this is something you will show in your homework. It's the first homework. But I thought it would be good to do the gradients on the last layer and let you do the other gradients on the intermediate layers. So the gradient of this with respect to this is something that we know. So what do you think would be this gradient? This one over here.
The derivative of the activation function.
Exactly, yeah. So that'll be just GL prime of Z JL. And then that derivative is something that we can extract based on the choice of the cost function. So if we choose a mean squared error, that would be something that we can derive easily. And if it's a log, if this the cross entropy, that's also something we can calculate. So I'll leave that term as it is because it's something that can be calculated analytically for good choices of this small cost function. Okay? So this is the first equation that we're going to use. Sorry, I'm going up as I'm writing. Yeah. So maybe I'll use now that blackboard.
Okay.
So now what about the previous layers or the intermediate hidden layers? So in that case, we need to backpropagate the gradients we got at the last layer to the previous layers. So in that case, we will show, like you'll have a chance to show in the homework, the first homework, using this equation, that this delta, which is the derivative of small c with respect to z in the intermediate layers, that this is equal to a sum over all k's, where k is neurons in the number of neurons in the next layer. So you'll need to sum over all delta k's of all the delta k's. So those are the gradients in the next layer and the L plus one layer times the weight matrices, weight parameters. So this is T is the transpose, and here JL is the derivative with respect to the nonlinear activation function. So I'm not expecting you to see this right away. So this is something that you'll have to figure out in the first homework assignment, which will be posted hopefully next week. Okay? So now the question that you might ask was, well, why do we care about this delta J, like L? Well, if we want to compute the derivative with respect to weights at a layer L, then you can see here that we can again use the chain rule with respect to Z, so that where Z is given by this expression here. So again, you'll be given the opportunity to show in the homework that this is equal to the following. So you will see that delta JL will provide you with the gradients on the weights, and also delta J will also provide the gradients with respect to the bias. So this is equation 3, and this is equation 4, okay? So I've helped you to show this equation. Now you'll have to show 2, 3, and 4 in the first homework, okay? And one comment I want to make at the end is that this equation will give you a sense of why this is called backpropagation, because in order to get the gradient at layer L, you assume that you need the knowledge about the gradients in layer L plus 1. So this is why we need to go actually backward from capital L to 0 instead of going from 0 to capital L. Because we show that we know delta J at the last layer. So this is kind of an initialization that we can use to run this equation to find the layer, the gradients in the previous layers in the middle. So we start from here, and then we go back until we identify all the gradients in the previous layers. I didn't have a chance to show you the algorithm of backpropagation as if it looks like a code, but if you want, you can find that in the lecture notes. So I encourage you to see that in detail, so that you can connect the dots that we've seen in the lecture today. Since we have only about 2 minutes, like I also wanted to talk about overfitting, but you know, I might not have a chance to talk about that in detail. All I wanted to show you is a demo for how overfitting would play when you train feedforward neural networks. So let me show you a quick demo that would motivate the topic of the next lecture next week. Okay, so as you see here on the playground, I'm using a neural network architecture. So where here I'm defining like these two clusters that you can separate with a line, right? So I'm adding some noise. You're gonna understand why this noise will be important. And here, by click on this button, I'm showing the test data, which is also follows the same distribution in such a way that you can separate most of the data points by a line. And if we run, if we add these additional features that are irrelevant, for instance, x1, 2, x2, 2, the products of x1, x2 to the inputs, this means that we're kind of over-parameterizing the neural networks. We're adding something that's not necessary to the training. So if we, this is something that we would typically do if we have many parameters that are unnecessary. So the addition of these features as a proxy to show you that what happens in the regime of over-parameterizing your neural network. So if we train now, you see that it's going down, the training loss is going down. But if you notice here, we have the test loss. So this is the loss or the cost that we have on the test data points. So those are data points that were not seen by the neural network. So these are like data points that are outside the training data, okay? So what you see here is that the test loss is going up compared to the training loss. So this means that the neural network is not generalizing well. And you can also see that from this boundary decision layer, which is something that's not ideal. You want a line between the two data sets. So one thing to cure this is something we're going to see in the next week. So you can use regularization techniques. So one technique is called L2 regularization. So it has some parameters like this regularization rate that we will use later on. I just wanted to show you the effect of this regularization. So once we use it, you see that we kind of cure this overfitting, which is not quite here. Maybe I could use a bigger value. You see, like it's kind of like helps with overparameterization, and you'll see why that helps in the next lecture. I just wanted to motivate this important limitation that can be cured as well with some techniques that will be shown in the next lectures next week.